Welcome to episode 6 of All of Your Business with Michael Jonas. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents rise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. This episode is brought to you by Bridgeliner, Oregon Health Authority, and COVID-19 Freelance Artist Resource. On this episode, Michael speaks with Court Morse, the Equity and Inclusion Program Manager for Prosper Portland. Prosper Portland creates economic growth and opportunity for Portland. Their vision is to make Portland one of the most globally competitive, healthy, and equitable cities in the world. All of Your Business is hosted by creator and executive producer, Michael Jonas.
How are you doing?
I'm 2 thumbs up. It's a rough day, but it's always in the work, so that's good.
Yeah. I've never heard someone give emojis as how they're feeling.
Well, yeah.
I'm doing eggplant peach today.
Yeah, totally. I'm doing rainbow dolphin.
So Court, tell us about you. I know that's a very broad question.
Yeah. I was born 8 pounds, 3 ounces. No, I have no idea. I identify as a lot of different things. Two-spirit, which is a indigenous, it's an English term, but it has indigenous connotations of being an LGBTQ indigenous person. I identify as gender nonconforming, as an activist, as a triple Aries. So that's Aries with an Aries moon and an Aries rising. So I'm just all fire. A plus size badass, a human being, someone who's learning.
I like that one.
Yeah, always learning. queer, 33-year-old. Who's had a long journey to get to Oregon. I came from Wisconsin originally. And yeah, ever since I was a little kid, I either wanted to like save the whales. I looked at like my kindergarten journals and it was like, I wanted to be a firefighter. And I've always had this sense that like, there's some shit wrong with the world. And so, you know, we got some cleaning up to do.
Yeah.
Well,
there is some shit wrong with the world. And we have some cleaning up
Thanks
to do.
Thanks for the validation. and then when I was 18, I headed out to Portland and started figuring out that there were other people like me who do activism-y things. I've been very blessed in life. I have a beautiful family. I've been in love. I've seen the ocean. I've had a lot of really cool experience. If I die tomorrow, hopefully not, I will say I have an awesome life so far. So, yeah.
Well,
does
wonderful.
That sort of is that all in a nutshell?
That was everything.
Are we done now?
We have identity. We have goals. It's not too late to save the whales.
Yeah, I know. There's some that are making a comeback, so that's good.
Yeah,
yeah. I think it's the humpbacks. I really do. I think they're returning. I was watching a like Shark Week episode. Anyway, so that's good.
Well, tell me about that. Like, why do you like being an activist? Like, what makes you an activist?
I don't know. I've been sort of chasing that. I think because I kind of compare myself to other people. Like, what makes someone have that drive? I think that like most of us just feel like we should help out. You know, like you both and other people that I meet. But we're always in this little bubble of people like us. And then I wonder about the people who like don't feel like they have to help out. And it's kind of like when someone's having a heart attack and everyone throws out their cell phones and they're like taking a video of it. And you're like, what is going on with this world? But then there's just a lot of us that are like, no, that's just, you know, that's just common sense. That's how I was raised. That's you have to help those in need. So I think it was the way I was raised. And I think it was my calling. Just like how some people in my life have been like, man, I couldn't do what you do. And I'm like, I couldn't do what you do. Like, yeah. I couldn't be a lawyer.
I mean, think you could be. Maybe.
Like, I'd probably be like, I'd probably get some stuff done. But it would. It's not like where I'm supposed to be. And you just have that feeling of like the thing you're supposed to do that I think is your gut instinct. And some of us are really blessed that we get to do that. Not a lot of people have the opportunity to do activism. Mm. Or they have to do it in their own ways or they don't get paid for it. So I feel really lucky. And I just think it was what I was born to do. And I think most people try to do the right thing. But then again, you meet people who just are in their own little bubble and don't feel like they have to at all. So
yeah, you mentioned being raised in Wisconsin and making your way to Oregon. What was that like growing up in Wisconsin?
Lots of cheese. The stereotypes are true. I actually just visited Wisconsin. My brother, my mom, my brother's wife, and then my dad passed away like 5 years ago. But everyone was like in Wisconsin. And I went, the first thing I did was go to the deli. And like, there's just like 80% of the deli is mayo salads. Like, think of anything you want to put in mayo. And like, Wisconsin people will figure out how to like, like fruit mayo salad and just all sorts of noodly, potatoey.
Mayo salad. Isn't that ambrosia?
Yeah, something like that. But somehow there's always a way to sneak mayo in it. That is just a side tangent about Wisconsin. It's a really beautiful place. Like, when I'm there, I feel home. But I feel like I have either two hearts or half a heart in Wisconsin and one in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But I've been grieving recently because I realized that, like, homophobia has made it so I can't live there. And, like, that, there's a lot of things that tear apart families, whether it's, like, immigration or, you know, alcoholism or just, but, like, literally, like, I feel like I can't live there and be as empowered as I am. And I also, there's not political jobs, but there's less of a market there. And so it's both haunting because I don't feel like I can be there, and yet so beautiful because it's like home.
Sure.
But it, you know, it's very conservative. People are like very nice. That means they hide a lot of their feelings in some ways. And so I was raised to be like, not political, don't stir the pot. Not me raised by my family, but like raised by society there to like just be the nice, quiet.
But you also have to be yourself.
Exactly.
And you also have to defend yourself. So
yeah.
I can see how the two of those wouldn't really
mesh
well.
Yeah. I remember like walking my dogs at like 2 a.m. Like other people went out to parties and I just couldn't sleep. And I would walk my dogs in the snow and I'd listen to like Enya and I'd be like, there's something out there, man. And so all my friends were applying for college and I was like, I looked up in the sky and I was like, all right, man, if I'm meant to leave this town, this small ass conservative town, and go do something with my life, I was like, just show me. You're so fancy up there. Like, show me something.
You're so fancy.
And there's this like shooting star that like, right when I was pissed off, I looked at the sky.
God, it's
yeah.
me in court.
Yeah, exactly.
Yo, God.
I should write a book about that. Margaret stole it from me.
Though. Right?
Yeah.
Well, Enya, I mean, what else? Was there...
I trailed after my brother in the rock and roll world. He loved Nirvana and the Toadies and my
Please
dad...
Please tell me Jagged Little Pill, Alanis Morissette made it.
Yes.
Made it to your
yes,
life.
Yes, definitely. I would just go like in his room and rummage through his CDs and take his t-shirts. And that's when I realized I think I was like butch because I kept wearing all of his t-shirts and he would get mad and embarrassed. He'd be like, do you know how embarrassing it is to be in high school and then watch your little sister like walk with your shirt around? And I was like, I don't know.
And you said, don't be jealous. I look better.
Exactly. I rock the shit better. My dad listened to Pink Floyd and rock and roll. My mom listened to oldies. So I feel like I had... And then there's the 90s crap that every kid listens to, you know, Spice Girls and just like, which now I still, you know, still shows up in my playlist every now and then. So.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to admit that. That's fine.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I still sing along to Christina Aguilera, Genie in a Bottle.
Yes.
I don't care what people think.
Yeah, exactly. You got to get it, you know. Do you have shower song?
There's so many.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many. Yeah, I don't even know.
I feel like
I don't
shower
even know where to begin
song
with that.
And shower beer are like two practices of like, how can I maximize my shower? And so I like to have shower song and sometimes shower beer. So
depends on my mood and how good I believe I sound. I mean, maybe one day it's a Whitney dance with somebody moment.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's...
Which can get slippery.
Yeah.
So.
Or like a Cyndi Lauper True Colors.
Yes.
The hard part is our shower right now is really thin and skinny. It's not... It's kind of like a time capsule, so we can't really... There's not really a lot of dancing room. I might bust through a door.
Yeah, totally.
Not trying to break glass.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
I've actually told my boyfriend, you know, we eventually buy a house. That's one thing that I want is I want a shower that I can like walk in, dance in.
Yes, exactly. I want like a double shower. Like just I want people to be able to join me and like we can all dance, you know. Put that on our wish list.
Well, cool. I mean, we can talk about anything, right?
But, yeah.
You know, I really, this is me taking a deep dive.
Yeah, go for
it. I really want to talk about Standing Rock.
Yeah.
I'm impressed with you for so many reasons. That is one reason. Can you talk about that? Like you going there and doing your thing?
Totally. I really appreciate that.
And the fucking Dakota Pipeline is leaking as we thought that it would.
Shocker. I know. Yeah, it was an experience of a lifetime. I think I'm always so humbled by it because like there were people there that did so much more and like were there so much longer and endured so much. And I think that some people like glorify Standing Rock. There was like 4,000 people there at one point, and a lot of white people and a lot of people who like wanted to come be like weekend warriors and
I know
the intent was good in some
ways. Becky with her Instagram Photoshop.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's me with a native.
Yeah. I mean, and like it's kind of like the Ally industrial complex where it's like Puerto Rico, like everyone, my friend Mira Moschini, who's an amazing trainer, just did a training on the Ally industrial complex. And she was like, Puerto Rico is a great example. Like, we sent so much stuff there that no one needed. Like
Paper towels were thrown at them.
Yeah, like, who needs a blanket in Puerto Rico and, like, culturally inappropriate food? And then their ports got clogged, so they couldn't do a lot of, like, local organizing. And I think that happened at Standing Rock. But, you know, first and foremost, like, when you enter Standing Rock, it's a traditional Lakota war camp. So, like, everything is super traditional protocol. And there were flags everywhere for like all the different tribes that were there that got permission to camp there. And, you know, I'm rolling with my best friend, Candy Brings Punny, like over the hills. And she's Oglala Lakota Sioux. And she's like, dude, we have to go out there.
What tribe are you?
I'm Sioux St. Marie Chippewa, which is actually just my enrollment. But Chippewa is a bastardization of the word Ojibwe, which in our language is also known as Anishinaabe. So when I introduce myself, it's like a complicated thing. But my peeps are all up in Upper Michigan, like Midwest area, sometimes a little bit on the East Coast. But Candy is like from the area. So she's like, dude, we got to go. And then she said, we also have to go because we have to represent Two-Spirit people. And we have to let them know that there are Two-Spirit warriors out there. And that there always have been Two-Spirit warriors. And I was like, okay. So we hop in the truck and we
drive
out.
Did you ask, what do I bring?
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, there were the logistics and the, like, big coats and everything. And
because it's cold. It's cold out there.
There was a reason that people, like, had to keep moving traditionally because it was just so cold, you know, that it was, like, unbearable temperatures. And so I remember the first time, like, we're in the truck and we're, like, rolling over and the first view of Standing Rock, like, it's like that moment when time stops or it's just something so profound that your eyes are seeing that you just, like, can't even remember your name or, like, it was just one of those moments. And then when you actually entered in the camp, it felt like you were entering, like, a spiritual sphere, like, literally you felt like you were going back in time even though you were in like a modern truck or whatever because the way that it was laid out was like so traditional that you're like, wow, like this is how my ancestors lived, you know, and this is how they gathered and this is how they prepared for war. Like it was teepees everywhere, like, and for an urban Native American person you don't really get to experience that every day. And so we kept our fires sacred. We sang and prayed at the front lines. We, you know, from the moment we woke up, there was this guy. He had a big microphone that you could hear everywhere all across camp because it was so traditional, but it also we had these modern tools. And so you could make announcements like so-and-so lost their kid or we're about to like sing a song or, hey, it's the water ceremony. But this elder would get up on the microphone like around 5:30. And if you weren't up at sunrise, you were basically, like, tardy. And
5:30 a.m.
Well, like, 5:30 is when he'd get on the microphone. But, like, sunrise, if you're being super traditional, you do ceremony at sunrise and you, like, wake up with the sun. And so he would get up and he'd be like, kiktapo, or is how I think you pronounce it, and which means like not just like get up, but like get up, you know, like rise up, like get up.
Yeah, dude. That's beautiful.
And so he'd be on the microphone and, you know, you'd be so tired because you just got like 3 hours of sleep because it was like super cold and, you know, and he'd be like, what did you come here to take selfies or to fight, you know, fight the Dakota Pipeline? So it was just this really motivating moment where you're like, oh, my God, I got to get up, you know. And then we did water ceremony every day.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So water ceremony was to pray to the Cannonball River, which was a tributary to the main river, and we would sing a water song, thanking Creator for the water, and we would offer tobacco to it. And one of the reasons we were there is because we needed to represent the Two-Spirit people and the queers, and colonization brought homophobia and transphobia. And so there's some natives that you know, are homophobic or transphobic, and there's some who aren't, just like every race, you know. One of the things that we were trying to do is remind people that we have a place in our Native American society, because there's over 580 tribes in just the United States, and they all have different customs related to gender and sexuality, and a lot of that was colonized through homophobia and transphobia. And so we used to have traditional roles, and some of the ways that we used to have traditional roles were we had special medicine as Two-Spirit people. Everyone has special medicine, but our medicine was related to the fact that we had, you know, this combination of masculine and feminine views and medicine. And so sometimes it would be that we were the healers of like conflict or name givers. Some elders told us that Two-Spirit people were feared because they could change the weather. Some people told us that, like, in the olden days, you'd have some warrior dude come out in a full-on, like, skirt, or you'd have this butch woman with, like, six wives, and, like, the white people just did not know what to do with that, you know? So, like, scared them even more. And
well, and your point, I think, is what popular culture, modern culture may see as different, strange, not attainable, was actually something that was magical,
yeah,
often heralded.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was, you know, that was the thing about water ceremony. I forgot what I was rambling about, but at water ceremony, you have a male role and a female role. And so the men are to help the women down to the river, not in this like patronizing way, but in this like ceremonial way. And then the women like sing and wear dresses, you know? And I can't stand wearing dresses. Mm. I identify as a woman, but also as gender nonconforming and also as masculine. And so I have like a lot of fluidity. So ceremonies can be really anxiety producing for gender nonconforming people. And so we were kicked out of ceremony for a while. Like we were told to go back to the camp, put a skirt on. We were told that we couldn't, that men couldn't wear dresses. You know, there'd be like a bearded Two-Spirit person with a dress on and they'd be ashamed or whatever. But then there were other Native people there that were like, no, these are our Two-Spirit people and they belong here and they've always been here and they have special medicine. So it was a movement within a movement, because we were there at Standing Rock fighting the pipeline together, and then we were also there like reclaiming our space as Two-Spirit warriors. And I remember when we got accepted at the camp, you know, elders told us that we were saving lives, because one of the biggest rates of suicide is Two-Spirit youth. And so with modern day age of Facebook and seeing that rainbow flag above the teepee and knowing the stories, like we're letting Two-Spirit youth know that it's okay to be a warrior. It's okay to be on the front lines. We were always warriors and we're here now. But now that story we got to like reclaim. So
no, that's really beautiful. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, of course.
And then it is a true known fact that Native Americans in general, they have a high or higher suicide rate. Mm-hmm. So having both, you know, being Native American and being Two-Spirit, but also just seems like there's a lot of push and pull of some of the world wants to think that that's wonderful. Some of the world thinks that it's not wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of questioning of, you know, who am I? Am I special? Am I a warrior? Mm-hmm. Or am I not a warrior? So for you, I mean, how did you develop enough strength, whether it was when you're young or whether it was recent, to actually call yourself a warrior, believe that you're beautiful, which you are.
Thank you. Same.
And hashtag same. And to take that and to use it to push forward, because you could have backed down, you could have, you know, compromised who you were and basically acted like people wanted you to act.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what was sort of the defining moment you feel for yourself?
Damn, that's a good question. Well played. it's like you know how to interview people or something.
Something like that.
you know, there's a few things, ingredients, if you will. One is my parents always accepted me for who I was, like unconditionally loved me. We were like the messy, broke family that like there was duct tape on the walls and every Friday we'd bring down the mattresses and like our dogs would have like mud running throughout the house. And like we just didn't care. Like we were like, this is who we are. We love each other. We're messy. You know, we're forward. There was no hiding. And I think privilege like sometimes allows people to really hide and like be very comfortable and have to put on this like persona of like perfection. And sometimes I wouldn't trade being broke as a kid for anything because it
hashtag same.
Yeah. Right. It like teaches you just to be raw.
We lost our house when I was young and
yeah,
lost my apartment after the recession too. So
damn. Yeah,
but you know, you're right. There's moments like that where they actually make you think, they make you stronger.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have a choice. You either keep up with that or you find a way to push forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. I you know, I feel solidarity with you because I know that we both chose to push forward and like I think everyone needs to struggle a little, honestly. And we're like, you know, even my privilege as like a US born citizen, me saying I'm broke is like so much privilege.
Yeah.
So like
we have clean water, we have bathrooms to use, we have somewhere to sleep.
Yeah, I went
at
to
night.
School, like, you know. So I think that actually that amount of struggle is like what every human should go through. Like just have only the things you need and go bike around town. You don't need like all these fancy things, you know.
But did you ever have a moment where, you know, someone made you feel as if you couldn't be two-spirit or you thought, I don't want to be this, you know, why do I have to be this?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Some sort of, you know, internal strife. Not that I'm searching.
No, no.
Because you know,
I was trying to get to a point.
You're
I
a strong, well-developed woman, but
yeah.
Or not woman. See, and
yeah,
and
I identify as a woman. You can call me dude. Also, yeah, I think that I just wanted to pay homage to my parents, but there definitely was a moment like, so I was bullied, like so bullied, like. Man, was I bullied. I was like, I'm trying to put it on a scale like 1 to 10, but it was like every day, like at least 8 through 10, like just one of the kids at school that was the most made fun of. And it was because of my weight. I've always had a plus size warrior body. You know, I call myself a mountain. Our diet wasn't great. Like we didn't have access to like healthy foods all the time. And then, you know, genetically speaking, I think there's a lot of trauma that I carry from my ancestors who, like, were starving and, like, you know, we're going to make a fat grandbaby, like, so in case anything goes down. And then I was questioning my sexuality and I didn't tell myself I was queer till like, the 10th grade. And I was taught to be really nice and not political. So as tough as I was amongst my own peer group or in my family, I was the shyest person that you would ever meet. And I was the like nicest person. And but I still had this fire inside me that like there was shit going on with the world. And so there was always this like, but where's my outlet? You know,
sure. That seems like a lot of push and pull.
Yeah. And so I was raised in a really conservative high school in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And at that time, it was a brand new high school and they had TVs in every classroom. And a lot of the teachers had on the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad as like the background. And I'm like, how distracting is that? You know, and they thought, OK, like at least we're showing the kids the news. And but I was like, I'm trying to pay attention to like geometry. And in the right hand corner of my eye, I'm watching innocent people get killed. And I'm supposed to like normalize that. Like what the? So I was talking to my brother and some other friends and we decided to throw a protest, a walk out on the Pledge of Allegiance. Also, if you didn't say the Pledge of Allegiance, you got disciplined. And after every day they would play, I'm proud to be an American,
what?
As you like left school. So like this is like the climate I was up against.
Was there like a beauty queen pageant in your town as well?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I won it several times. No. So my friends and I are like, we're going to do this protest. So we like spread the word and the flyers and everything like this. And
this is 10th grade or?
This is 10th or 11th. So my friend Annette and I, we used to get donuts every other Friday and pick up our paychecks from the grocery store. And so it was like really fun. You get your paycheck, you get your donut. And so we're like sitting in the car eating donuts. And I'm like, oh my God, it's almost time for people to walk out. Like, what are we going to do? I'm like, what if like two people show up? And she's like, it's fine, dude. It's fine. You know, even if it's just you and me. So all of a sudden, like hundreds of kids walk out of the school. And I'm like, oh my God, this little idea like turned into some epic big
thing.
Was
the protest about the Baghdad?
Yeah, it was against the war in Iraq.
Okay.
And it was just like we knew that the missiles were not that smart. We could read through the BS. Like, we knew it was about oil. So everyone was looking around for a leader. Everyone's like, my brother's like, so what do we do? You know, like, we all have our signs and stuff. And I'm like, I don't know. And
you're like there with your clipboard.
Yeah. He's like, well, I wasn't ready to go. I had no idea who was going to lead this thing. And he was like, well, let's go over to the main highway and then we'll walk to Veterans Park. I was like, good idea. And he's like, go on, lead us. And I was like, okay. And so I just started leading us, and I was chanting. And I think that was one of the most political moments where I was just like, people need leadership. Like, and it's not about me, you know, I love it because I'm a triple Aries. And so it's like always fun to stroke my ego. But like, humbly, I know that I'm no more important than other people. We're all built for different things. That's the whole point of Zodiac and like tribal roles is like, just because the leader is the person in front or the most visible does not mean they're not as critically important as the person doing the dishes.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, so.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's kind of cliche to say now, but it takes a village, but it really does.
Yeah.
And what I'm realizing now, you know, you talk about big changes, and I think we talked about this on the phone. You know, we need politics, advocates or activists. We need business.
Yeah.
We need nonprofits. Everybody needs to come together.
Yeah.
Like, that's how we're going to get the change that we need.
Yeah.
So I think it's daring of you to step out, and it takes a lot to step out. But the people who chose to step out and took those risks, that's how we have these changes.
Yeah.
I mean, everything you look at, like if you look at Selma, you look at, you know, Malcolm X, you look at Rosa Parks. I mean, every kind of figure, big, small, famous, not famous, even if it's a local school board, it takes someone. Here, look, Joanne Hardesty.
Yeah.
She don't give a fuck.
Yeah, I fucking love her.
You know, she will ask, well, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And they go, because we're doing it. She goes, why are we doing it?
Yeah.
And she'll sit there and ask over and over again.
Yeah.
So it takes people like that, like you, like her, to actually push the agenda forward and remind people the status quo is not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
We need to go on.
Yeah.
So yeah, you did it. You did it in 10th grade. You're doing it now.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Trying. You know, I've known Joanne in the community for years because she always had a clipboard. And when I was student body president, I always had a clipboard at Portland State University. And I'd be out there with like my butch clothes and like my little whatever stupid college like image I was going, my bowling shoes, you know, whatever the hell I was wearing. And I'd be getting people fired up. I'd be like, you know, did you know the administration is like screwing us over on this new rec center? And did you know that they're defunding ethnic studies? And isn't it crazy we don't have gender neutral bathrooms? They'd be like, yeah, fuck the man. And I'd be like, all right, sign this petition. They're like, who are you, by the way? I'm like, I'm the student body president. It doesn't matter. They're like, what? You know, you're the student body president? I was like, yeah, but like, it doesn't matter. You know, we're all here. And it's like so many people that sign those clipboards and give money and like put shit out there in their community that are behind the Joannes,
sure.
You know, and like, and that's how you do this shit. You have to have a clipboard in your hand. You have to do hard work for like, I was a political canvasser. I was on the street asking people if they had a minute for the whales and a minute for the gays. And, you know, this one time, like all these queers kept passing me and no one had a minute. And this one pig farmer walks up to me And he's like, and I'm in Salem, Oregon.
Like legitimately a pig farmer?
Yeah, legitimately
or
a pig farmer.
He
no.
could potentially be a pig farmer.
No, I was like, what do you do? He's like, I'm a pig farmer. And I'm like, cool. You know, my name's Court. And like, you know, and he's like, what are you doing out here today? I'm like, I'm canvassing for the Human Rights Campaign. And he's like, cool. He's like, tell me what it's up, you know? And I was saying, did you know you can't, we don't have all 1,100 federal rights and benefits and yada, yada. He's like, that's messed up. And so he gets
that's
out.
That's a muddy situation.
Yeah, that's a tricky situation. Put some bacon on that, you know? So he pulls out a checkbook and he writes a $1,000 check. And wow. I was like, dude, that's such a big gift. What inspired you to give today? And he's like, I just think, you know, everyone deserves their rights. And I was like, but yeah, but there's got to be some like lesbian sister or something that like motivated you. And he's like, no, you know, I don't know any gay people. And, yeah. You know, that's it's just it's beautiful to think of how many activists are out there like that, you know?
What you just said reminds me that when we think about interest and not positions, mm-hmm. we actually have a lot more in common than we don't.
Yeah.
And it's really hard right now to talk to people because we have people who don't believe in facts. Mm-hmm. We have people who will tell you that being hateful is a difference of opinion. They'll be like, you're a progressive liberal. Yeah. I'm a neo-Nazi. Yeah. We're the same.
Yeah.
You have a group. I have a group. And I'm like, no, hate is not a group.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. But what I'm getting at is, okay, everyone doesn't want their child to be shot at school. Mm-hmm. They want to be safe. Everyone needs clean water, clean air. You know, everyone needs roads, infrastructure, like all these things that are interest related.
Yeah.
And the other thing is when you talk about love and you talk about people living their best life, if you don't put it in a context that's politicized.
Yeah.
And then I have the problem where I think politics is life, mm-hmm. which I don't know if that's a problem or a blessing, but I see that politicians actually do fix things and mm-hmm. make things better.
Yeah.
But I think that's what we need maybe is we need more people like you out there figuring out what those common interests are.
Yeah.
And then finding that,
oh,
you know.
Man.
You're a pig farmer. I'm trying to take a description that you gave me. I'm in my 90s clothes and I'm a butch lesbian.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't matter because we both care about the environment.
Yeah. Well, I think that your point is absolutely where this movement needs to go. I don't say politics. I say power. Everyone's like, especially because I was brought up not to talk about politics. Now I'm just pissed off and I'm taking it back. I was like, I wasn't trying to talk about politics. I was trying to talk about power and like stop telling me I can't talk about power, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing is if we had a movement centered around our common interests and love, it's just so not popular. It's not sexy, but it is the work. Like, it is the work. I just when
don't
we,
tell that to Bob Marley.
Yeah, I know, right? For me, we were smudging the cops at Standing Rock. Like, they were afraid of our drums and our feathers and our spirit and our prayers. Like, that's what scared the crap out of them. And every day we said, "We're out here praying for your kids to have water. Mm. We love you." Like,
and did they have like pellet guns,
AK-47s,
okay,
like grenades. I mean, they had tanks out there, and we.
I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised.
You know, it got really real. We were all shot at this one day by a Dapple worker with a live gun who said, "You effing retards!" And there was an elder with us, and he tried to run over the elder. And, like, fired shots, like, right above our heads. And I was like, this is really real. Like, this is where this shit gets real. And I was, like, super safe compared to what some of my friends dealt with. But, you know, that's what got to the cops was praying for them and, like, singing to them every day. Like, you could see it in their eyes. Like, we're like, when your kids ask you what line you stood on, like, what are you going to tell them, you know?
Yeah.
And
you're right. I mean, people are just people at the end of the day. And when you actually talk to someone that's, you know, non-binary or trans, or you talk to someone who's Native American or Hispanic, you know, like all these walls come tumbling down.
Mm-hmm.
Like people do that where they play that game. Like, I think all Mexicans are immigrants who are taking my jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you meet someone and you're like, wow, you're DACA recipient and you're studying to be an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, holy crap, you're just like my son. You're just like my daughter. like, it's sad that it takes that extra level sometimes for people to find the humanity.
Yeah.
But I guess if that's what's needed to actually get there, then that's what we need to do.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's controversial because we also do have to talk about race. I'm not advocating a colorblind world. We have, like, and for people of color to be angry is so valid. Like,
oh, for sure.
You know, my blood boils. I just found out the residential school that my grandpa was put into, like, we were doing some family history stuff and I thought it was a different residential school. And, you know, like, I was like, that's what happened this week. I found out the, you know, where my grandpa was, like, snatched from. And so, like, I want to lean into those angry sides. And yet the most productive things that have happened in the movement, in my opinion, are when we learn to love each other from, like, a human. And that's why I sent you that song, I'm Not a Racist, because it, like, I wonder what would happen if we actually had, like, dialogue together. But there are a lot of people of color and a lot of other people that don't believe that that dialogue can fix anything anymore, that we've tried dialogue for too long,
sure.
That there is right to be angry, that, and also that in some cases we should be, like, we should have our own safe spaces, which is sure. Also valid. So it's complicated.
Well, I have a boyfriend and it's not cool to say woke anymore, so, because it's a very dad outdated term, but I'm pretty culturally aware, you know, but I'm privileged. I present as a cis straight white male, and I know that, and I think about that, but more so what I've thought about lately is I understand a lot of the anger better than I did before. So, you know, if I was a black mother who had to worry about her kid driving while black, sleeping while black in a dorm, hanging out while black, and being shot or, you know, whatever, stop and frisk for no apparent reason, not even reasonable suspicion, just you're on a corner at that time. I get it, because that mixed with all of the past history, there's so much deep, deep pain. So I think we need to all realize that this is real pain that does exist, that doesn't necessarily go away with time. And we need to all grow together. Part of that is yearning for education and learning.
Yeah.
And the other part of it is, and this is something we can talk about, is not telling people what they need, but asking them what they need.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what happens a lot, is it's very much like, here, this is what you need.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, historically, like, they did that with Native Americans. Like, here's some land. Yeah. Maybe you'll be happy. Like, no, that's not. Or
it's
like
a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah. Or like saying that we hire black people, but we really don't, because we code the applications.
Yeah.
Or we'll make room for you, but we're not going to fix the systematic racism or the institutionalized racism.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's like deeper digs. I don't know what I'm trying to get at, but the point is that it takes everybody to be open to this.
Yeah.
And it even takes, it's so hard. And again, I can't speak to it because I'm not a minority, but it takes minorities to trust some people who are white or present as white that they actually do care and they actually do want to learn. And I'm ready for that. I hope that the rest of America is ready for that.
Yeah.
I think that, I don't know how you assess that. Like, who's a lost cause and who's someone who's on a path to growth?
Well, those are some really interesting points, and I could go 14 different directions, so I'll choose maybe one. Well, I think that the best thing white people can do is talk to other white people. Who, you know, like, I think that there is so much work to do, yes, interracially, but I do a lot of, you know, trainings and workshops on diversity, equity, inclusion, and I'm sitting in a lot of rooms with a lot of people who are white and people of color, and I'm having a lot, like, every day I have at least one or two people come to me in tears, like, either white or people of color who are just, like, stressed out about this whole race thing. And so, like, I've learned a few things. I'm constantly learning, but I've learned a few things. And to me, like, my conclusion at this point is, like, I'm not always so sure that we should learn together. Like, I think that I've been also guilty of gearing a lot of my workshops towards white people, how to get white people to understand racism, how to get white people to not be afraid that they'll say something wrong, how to move white people from being an ally to an accomplice. Like, and then there's the people of color in the room just kind of being like,
how to not call the police at a barbecue.
Yeah. All those things. And then the people of color in the room are kind of like, okay, I'm glad I'm like getting some exposure to language to validate my experience, but like this isn't necessarily super helpful. And so I think that one of the biggest things white people can do is like share the labor of educating about racism with other white people specifically. And like one of my best friends has another best friend that she's been with for like 15 years of her life. They're both white. And she is like, this one white person is the only consistent in my life, like besides my mom, like the longest relationship I've had with anyone. But over the years, she's noticed that her friend has gotten a little bit racist. Mm-hmm. Like, and then her friend's husband is a cop. And so for my birthday, like, I wanted to go shooting because I thought it'd be really empowering to use a gun as, like, a queer indigenous person and at least know what the hell I'm up against with these racist assholes, you know? So I'm out there, like, in Estacada, like, firing weapons with, like, all these white dudes and, like, cops. And I'm just like, this is super weird. They were all very nice to me, but like I couldn't quite put my finger on it, you know? And I realized that I was not being myself the entire day. What I was doing was I was like code switching to make sure that I was safe with those white guys the entire day.
And were you like telling bad dad jokes?
Well, I always tell bad dad jokes. That's not something I'll discriminate against ever. It's like bad dad jokes are the way that I communicate 50% of the time. But yeah, I think like the point is we both said, I don't want to be in a place where I'm just tolerated. I want to be in a place where I can thrive and be like 100%. And she still can't talk to her friend yet about the fact that like they've grown apart because her friend's becoming racist. And I was like, man, if she can't talk to her best friend of 14 years about racism, who can, you know, like who can do this? It's actually really, really rare to see someone interrupt a microaggression at the grocery store. Is it actually really rare to see a white person in a meeting at work say, like, I've been working with people for like 10 years and I've given them so many tools and packets and kits, but like, I've like maybe a handful of times have I actually seen like a white person like in a meeting space in the moment just be like, this is messed up and racist, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and being, you know, and being, being not racist is not enough. You have to, you have to be about love and respect, and you have to call it out, like, because there are a lot of people who will be like, I'm not racist.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, there's a little bit more to it than that.
Yeah. Well, I actually know a lot of people who are white people that identify as racist because they know that.
As like a proud choice.
No, not as a proud choice, but as a very humble way of saying, no matter my good intent, like, I just know I'm capable of racism. Like, I know no matter what I do, my subconscious will do some racist shit.
Sure.
And so, like, they very, like humbly say, like, you know, it's almost like a AA meeting, like, you know, I'm so-and-so and I'm a racist. It's, like, just accepting that, like, you don't have to be ashamed for being white. You don't have to feel like it was your personal choice when you were, like, you know, like you're signing up for a race for the life and you're like, I'll take white for 400. You know, you didn't do that.
Well, and I'm glad you said that because I have been in situations where someone would call me a colonizer. Mm. Like, I didn't even know them. And I just thought, how are we ever going to have a conversation if the moment you meet me, you call me a colonizer? So, again, not complaining. I live a very privileged life. But I'm just saying, there's ways to do this and there's ways not to do this.
Have you ever called someone a breeder?
No.
No? I was like, as a queer person, I totally have. I you know, I'd be like with a bunch of straight people, so like, you breeders, you
That's
know,
really
like
funny.
Like as a joke, but like also just kind of like, or sometimes I'll be hanging out and they'll be like, some of us POC and some of us white people. Like I was at a dinner party the other night with some equity practitioners. It sounds so fancy, but like equity I never have dinner. Yeah, I never have dinner parties and I never have dinner parties with equity practitioners. But anyway, we were all talking and there was four people of color and one person had a white partner who was also hosting. And she was wearing a white shirt. I was like, did you mean to wear the white shirt tonight? Or, you know, just like little shit like that. Like, we have to be comfortable. But I could see if she was like feeling nervous about the sitch, and which she's not, she's like very experienced in talking about being white. But if she might have felt like that was an attack on her, like.
Sure.
And so I think that, yeah, I think language matters.
But here's the thing with you is you actually want to have these conversations. And I think that that's the issue we have right now as a society is it's either let's have very safe, superficial, eggshell walking conversations because I'm worried that everybody's going to be offended. Or if we have a really deep conversation, it drives me out and I go, no, I can't talk about this. So, like, we have to be, as a society, able to talk about these issues, which is what we're doing. And I think that I don't know why people are afraid of it. But I feel like there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, okay, we could have this conversation. I'm not going to go there. But that's sad in my mind because I think that that conversation is what could lead to growth.
I 100% agree with you. And I'm trying not to say but because I think there's ambivalence here. There's both truths, right? And we don't have to live in a binary society where it's like, this is the truth or this is the truth. So yes, that's the truth. And I'll add that, like, I'm a light-skinned person of color, you know, and they're my darker siblings, like, don't get to have safe conversations about race and have been fired over conversations about race or are fucking tired about having conversations.
Yeah,
so I think it's my role as a light-skinned person of color to be in that middle space. And I used to get a lot of shit. There was, when I was in college, I went to my first Women of Color class here down the road at PSU. And there was a professor, and she said, okay, we're going to have all the people of color go in one room and all the white people go in the other room. So I went to the people of color room, and, like, very politely, they were like, oh, sweetheart, you're in the wrong room. It's down the hall. Like 11A or whatever. I was like, all right, like, I'm getting pretty ghostly out here in the Northwest. But I was, like, super, like, shocked and a little jarred. And then I went to the White People Caucus, which felt really wrong. But I was like, I have to go participate. And the white people did the same fucking thing to me. They were like, oh, dude, sorry, buddy. You're in the wrong room. The people of color room's down the hall. So it's, like, me and this other light-skinned person of color crying in the hallway.
Oh.
The teacher said to go home and think about our identities. And, like, so I went in
just
my dorm.
To you or to everybody? And
to this other person that was also crying in the hallway. And I was, like, that was my first experience of, like, not realizing that I'll be fully accepted in either.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that that's my job as a light-skinned person of color is to travel this way where I get to, like, I used to hate it. Like, for 10 years, I had people say some fucked up shit about me. Like, I only date women of color because I secretly, like, you know, wish I was more of a person of color. Or when I date white people, they're like, Court's just dating a white person because they think that they wish they were white. And just, I've had so many people say some fucked up shit and judge me for, like, my skin color or my identity. And I used to hate it, and now I realize it is the biggest blessing in the world because I get to talk to both white people and people of color about this shit, and that is my job in this world. So I think some other people of color, like, are not going to be in the same place.
Yeah.
And I also agree, if we don't start having conversations, there's no way we're going to get through this racism thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate your candor in this interview.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to our conversation with Court Morse of Prosper Portland. We wanted to give a shout out to some wonderful local resources for COVID-19 related issues. Bridgeliner, live like you live here. Bridgeliner, a local event curation and promotion service, has put together a comprehensive crowdsourced list of ways to support Portland businesses who are open during this time. Head over to bit.ly/COVID-19-Bridgeliner for the complete list and ways to submit opportunities to be added to the list. Oregon Health Authority. Stay up to date on the latest information about Oregon's COVID-19 response, including dashboards and resources. The information can all be accessed at bit.ly/COVID-19-OHA. We also want to give a shout out to the COVID-19 Freelance Artist Resource. The Freelance Artist Resource Producing Collective has curated a list of resources specifically for freelance artists. Check them out at bit.ly/COVID-19-freelance resources. And now back to our conversation with Michael Jonas and Court Morse.
I know you do consultings and trainings, and then you also work for Prosper Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about not only what you do in a business employee sense, but how you basically use yourself as a person who experiences all these things and then translate that to a job?
Yeah.
Helping other people understand inclusion and equity.
Yeah. It's weird. We're like a new breed of employees, you know? Like, there was the 90s diversity training with the VHS tape, and like, I think the movement at that point was like, oh, shit, like, civil rights happened. We have new laws on the books now, and you're a lawyer, so, like, just basically we can't get sued. Like, don't be a dick, you know? So the trainings were like...
That's a law I learned. Don't be a dick.
Yeah. It's like the threshold was low, like you were talking about earlier. It's just like... The diversity of the 90s was like, don't be a dick. Everyone's welcome here. Like, diversity is good for business. And then people started realizing, like, oh, shit. Like, now we have a bunch of people of color here, and there's, like, but nothing's changing, or, like, they don't feel safe. And they realized that equality, like, giving everyone the same thing wasn't actually working. Equality is like having a piece of pizza, like a whole pizza pie on the table, and like one person has been starving for a week and the other person just had like this big lunch. And equality is saying, let's give them all a slice of pizza. Whereas equity is saying, like, feed the hungriest person. So then, like, people are like, oh, shit, we should probably do this equity thing instead of this equality thing. And then they're like, oh, but you can't have diversity and equity unless people feel included. So let's just do this inclusion thing. And then thus was born the diversity, equity, and inclusion breed of employees, which I think has taken shape, like, over the last 10 to 12 years. Like, people have been doing this work since, like, forever, since white man came here. But, like, the new language of it is, like, very academic, and, like, also the amount of that companies are spending on DEI initiatives, like, I'm not going to quote here, but it was like billions, I want to say. Like, it was just a lot of money. But yet they're not seeing, like, people of color necessarily be shifting, like, as far as recruitment and retention. So it's like, what's the big miss here? And there's just a bunch of us swimming in the sea of DEI world, equity practitioners trying to do the right thing. And we have a lot of conversations with people about race, racial equity, diversity, equity, inclusion. We help companies and organizations map, like, where to get started. Well, do you have an equity statement? Do you have, like, signage anywhere that says you care about things other than business, like, that you care about racial equity? What's the makeup of your company? How do you recruit and yet retain people of color? Do you develop people of color into leadership programs? Are you working with youth? Like, do you talk about race at work? And it's tricky business because sometimes these conversations work and you get over this big tidal wave of change. Mm-hmm. And, like, all of a sudden the company is, like, super, like, aware and kicking ass. But, like, 50% of the times you actually fail miserably and you end up, like, creating a lot of tension in the workplace and a lot of people of color bounce. And so it's high stakes, high rewards kind of work. I think for me, like, I'm trying to figure out how to do this sustainably because, like I said, I talk to a lot of people and I hold their emotions a lot.
And you're triple Aries.
Yeah. So that's probably why. But yeah.
So how do you know that people are legitimately wanting to do that? So, you know, like in corporate America, we have like pinking and greening,
yeah.
Like ExxonMobil will be like, we're a green company.
Yeah.
And on one hand, you know, people say, oh, like pride is being corporatized.
Mm-hmm.
But then another, there's been decisions where airlines have decided not to fly because of gay rights. So, like,
yeah.
Sometimes corporate America may be a good thing. I guess my question for you is, like, how do we get businesses to legitimately do this? And how do we know that they've done it versus just, we're going to look pretty and be surface level. We're going to sponsor a pride float. And then we're going to tell you that we're into this.
Yeah. Which, have you seen the pride floats lately? Like, it's going to become like a 10-hour parade.
I sat there for 4.5 or 5 hours watching every float.
Yeah, dude. It's like, thank you, 24-hour fitness. But, like, it's like...
Our firm's going to have a float this year.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
I'm excited about that.
Maybe I shouldn't knock, like... No. You, as, like, a queer business owner, should definitely be there.
Yeah.
I think some companies over the last years, I've urged not to join. Here's the difference. If you're in the Pride Parade, but you're not giving any contributions to the LGBTQ community, if you're not worried about the trans employment crisis, if you're not thinking about how to like degenderize all your forms, then you shouldn't be in the Pride Parade. You know what I mean? And I think that's the difference for companies is like, okay, sure, you have the Black Lives Matter, you know, poster up, but like, are you hiring Black people? Are you giving to the Black community? Are you talking about how anti-Blackness shows up in your workspace? Are you investing in trainers? Like, and are you shifting your workforce, or are you like creating wealth for Black people? Like that's like, you know, that's the ultimate goal, is to have all of our communities thrive. And so
do you think that those diversity hire numbers or diverse people wanting to work for those companies will be higher when people actually see that those are real changes that are made, that they right now they see a fake money buy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not authentic.
Yeah.
So do you think like maybe it's the authentic companies where we actually know that's they do care about Black lives, that we act, that those, you know, somebody who's Black actually gets that. They don't, they read through the, you know, the BS.
Yeah. I think authenticity is clutch. I'm not saying it's the only measure of success. Like, you can't just be authentic and not learning. You can't just be authentic and not making like moves. Like, power is never just given up freely. Like, I went to the Black Film or the African Film Fest like 2 years ago, and I was really triggered because all the white people were saving seats like in the first four rows, and they had jackets sprawled and they were white spreading, and like these Black elders were like literally walking up steps with canes trying to figure out a place to sit. And I was like, I just stood up, like, I'm an equity trainer, so I was like, my blood was boiling.
I was just like,
I went to go talk to the person. I said, can you make an announcement about how awkward this is that, like, people are taking up white space at an African Film Fest? And then they didn't want to do anything. And
it's
I was
also
like,
just common decency.
I mean, I know.
If someone is, not only is it a Black festival, but if you have elders who need a place to sit, like, this is common decency.
It's chair. Like bus rules, you know? And but like ultimately, so I went up to the person, they're like, oh gosh, I'm so sorry you feel that way. And like, you're right, you're absolutely right. We needed to have like, you know, the funders here because they put money towards the fest. And I was like, look, you don't even have to be a jerk about it. All you have to do is go up to the microphone. I was like, I'm an equity trainer, I'd be happy to make an announcement. And I was like, all you have to say is, can we please make room for folks in the space, particularly Black folks? This is an African Film Fest.
And that's a really friendly way of saying it.
Instead of being literally like, spoon-fed her.
Instead of being like, all you lazy-ass white people taking advantage.
Totally.
And,
I like,
and continuing to hold these people down.
I made it the nicest thing ever.
Get your asses up.
Yeah, like I could have screamed at them, but I didn't, right? I like spoon-fed her. The nicest script in the world. And I even offered to say the words for her, and she still said no. And I looked her in the eye, I said, this was your moment.
She said no to the announcement.
Yeah. I said, this is your moment. I was like, you ever been to a microaggression training? And she's like, yeah, plenty of them. I was like, this was your moment. This was your moment to do something, and you're choosing not to do it.
Well, but even that, it doesn't seem like a big task, and yet it is so big because
you're giving up power.
Yeah.
And so like that's what this work takes. So I went back to my seat and I said, I'm going to the overfill room because I'm not African American and this is an African American Film Fest, and I think we should be giving up our seats for people who've like endured racism. Mm-hmm. So I was like, so I, you know, whatever the fuck that did for people, but I think that's the authenticity is giving up power.
I like your messaging. Not only did I like your communication to her that you described, but I like the message that you said she could have said.
Yeah.
There would have been another thing where you just start screaming and say, like, everybody get up. And I've seen that done, too. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
What would have been so wrong or so hard for her to have done that? I don't think anything.
Yeah.
I don't think anything.
Well,
but the question is, like, are people afraid? Are they... like, I might lose a funder if I ask this person to leave.
She'll make you uncomfortable. And when you're not authentic, you're not... okay, when you're not doing the work, you're comfortable. If you're doing the work and you're authentic, you're going to be uncomfortable. And so we've prioritized white people's comfort of doing anti-racism work. Like, in that moment, sure, I'm sure she hustled her butt to get funders. I'm sure she helped curate awesome black films. I'm sure she was such a good white lady in so many ways. But like but the task that was her giving up her credibility and power and making someone uncomfortable, that's where she drew the line.
Yeah.
And
it's absolutely insane that she would do all the other things, but to actually let someone sit is a far cry or far ask.
Yeah.
Like that's just so crazy.
Yeah. And how triggered are those people? I mean, I'm sure they're used to it all the time, but like, you know, to go to an African film fest and not be able to sit anywhere, like, you know, it's just like, then what is the point of your experience? Again, you're not doing it with the community, informing it and leading it, because you put in all these beautiful hours to have this empowering experience for who? For white people to go see an African film and like check that off their diversity list for the night? You know what I mean? Like, diversity bingo is
so
not...
So what you're describing is kind of what I was asking about of, you know, we have to... Like the power thing, we have to give people power. We have to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
We have to ask them what they want or need, not tell them what they want or need.
Yeah. You got it. That's the work. You were like, what is it? What's the difference? You know, like authenticity and power.
I mean, it's sharing. A work in it's a work in progress for me. And I think for everybody, I think that's a big part.
Yeah, me too, man.
I think that's a big part of progress. And you mentioned learning. I mean, I try every day to never stop learning.
Oh yeah, me too.
And the interesting thing about progress too is it takes maintenance. There's no assumption of it's going to continue. I mean, there could be a Supreme Court case. There could be a government. I mean, we still have kids in cages.
Mean when?
You know what I mean? Like it's an everyday, continual, you know, growing process.
That's the question I have for you. Maybe is like, I'm all caught up in this stuff. I can't tell if we're making progress or not. Like, I think in so many ways we are, and then in so many ways we're not. Like, and when I do the history of racism, where I talk about how racism has happened since the first contact of white people, like, the biggest reaction I get to that training, which is a super mindfuck for everyone, is like, wow, we haven't done anything. And like, that just discounts all the good people and all the amazing activists and everything. But then at the same time, if I look at the state of the world, I'm like, fuck, we're like taking two steps forward, one step back.
I think there is progress. But I hear you. I mean, we live in a time of neo-Nazis. We live in a time of racism, and it may not be cool, you know about reverse racism, of course. You know, it may not be cool to say, oh, that black person, that's my drinking fountain, but you don't drink next to them, or you don't sit next to them, or like what I was talking about earlier is you say you hire black people, but then you code it and you never hire black people. So there's a lot of averse, latent racism that's happening, and lately I think that it's been emboldened by the administration, so people feel comfortable expressing however they feel. But I really do feel like there's progress. I mean, we see a lot of intercultural projects that I think are really about love, that are actually real. We see communities of color that are finally at the table, you know, and not at the table of in a chopping block sort of way, but as someone who's involved with the decision making. So I don't know. I like to think that there's progress.
Yeah, I mean, I have to hope that there is. And like, whenever I talk to elders about all this, they're just like, haha, you guys are so funny. Like, you don't even know what like struggle is, first of all. And second of all, like you just have to keep praying and you have to keep smudging and you have to keep doing what we've been doing for like millions of years, because it's been working. So like, you know, my grandpa always told me, like, when you operate out of your ego when you're young, it serves you really well. It gets you places. But as the older you get, like, that's when you realize you just have less control over all this shit.
Yeah. And,
you know, you become humbled.
I appreciate you, because you're doing a lot of hard work. And I think part of advocacy is the message, but part of it is being you in that spot.
Mm.
So by people seeing you, you're representing the public more. So, you know, we talked about Joanne Hardesty.
Yeah.
The fact that a black woman is on a council with white people, like, each new person, whether they're Native American, black, queer, that is representing society and is at the table where power decisions are made.
Yeah.
To me, that's progress.
Yeah, for
Again,
sure.
not perfect, but I mean, I look at the squad in Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, that's exciting to me. I look at political movement. I look at Stacey Abrams doing fair voting. That whole thing is a mess of people not being able to vote.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I see movement, but it's a scary time. Yes.
Yeah.
The one thing I was going to say, and then we're going to ask the five questions that we ask every time.
Yeah.
Is one of the things that's really important that I've been thinking a lot lately is education. You know, we have in textbooks like a sentence or two about slavery.
Yeah.
Like no, or we have the Trail of Tears. It's two sentences.
Yeah.
And it's like children don't know, or gay rights. Like they hear, it's like so some places don't allow the gay rights.
Uh-huh.
If it, I say the gay rights.
Like, the gay rights.
The gays.
Have you had a dose of the gay rights?
So, yeah, you might catch it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, some people don't allow it, some counties and things like that. And then when you have it, it's like, okay, Harvey Milk, Stonewall, name a couple things, bye.
Yeah.
Next chapter.
Toodles.
So my worry is for the youth, I guess we're still young, but the youth beyond, do they know what it took to get to where they are? Do they know about these stories? Do they know about these sacrifices? Mm-hmm. Do they know the history of America, which is a dark, dark, fucking dark history?
Yeah, so dark.
Of institutionalizing, colonizing, every word. I'm trying to think of every word possible.
Yeah, all the eyes.
And I get the like, oh, well, we don't want our kid to know about these hard things. But then I also get that that kid gets out in society and doesn't actually know the reality of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think education is clutch. You know, as you were talking, I was like, I better.
Yeah, bro.
I have a story about a clutch. But anyway, I think that as you were talking, I was like, our elders are probably saying the same thing about us. Like, do they know what it was like to have the first gay bar, or like, you know, be hired as a butch, or like, you know, just all the or survive orphanage school? You know, like, I bet they're saying the same stuff. And the question is, like, how do we pass it on? Like, we all, like, that's that oral tradition. That is, you know, isn't on like any sort of media. Well, this podcast is a great step, right? But like, yeah, I hope that they'll hear our stories. And the best thing we can do is just keep telling them, you know, because that's how you pass along the history. And I know certainly my history was whitewashed growing up. And so I wish I would have had a conversation like this I could have listened to, you know?
Oh, thank you. So let's get to our five questions.
Our final five for 400 points.
Was that your Alex Trebek?
Yeah. Wait, did you want to hear my clutch story?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really quick, but I used to work for an LGBT organization, and there was this very flamboyant, like, dude, and then there was this really butch, like, woman, and they were always kind of, like, on each other's nerves every now and then. So I walked into the lobby, and I was like, what are you guys fighting about, you know? And I detangled their mess, and it was because the butch woman thought that they were talking about like a car clutch, and the flamboyant gay man was talking about a purse. And I was like, you guys are literally too gay to communicate. Like, you just, so that's what they're arguing. They're like, oh, like a clutch. Okay. So anyway, well, you'd enjoy that.
How did they think that they were the same? Like,
I don't know how it all started necessarily.
Like,
but
I look good with my clutch.
Yeah. And like, the one person was hard of hearing, and it was just like a whole mess. So
gays.
Gays. Clutch.
Okay, so question number one, if you weren't doing what you're doing now, so, you know, training businesses, business owners on equity and inclusion, teaching them things like BIPOC, like, what would you be doing?
What would I be doing for the cause, or like, what would I be doing for myself? Well, so I have two answers.
Bills.
Oh, to pay my bills. Oh, I don't know. I don't care so much about bills. Like, I keep thinking that I should be on the next front lines, like the water pipeline fights in Canada, or sorry, the oil pipeline fights in Canada, and just the water protecting work that needs to happen right now. But I also, having been there, was like, is that where I'm supposed to go? Is jail for like, is that what I'm supposed to do? Is put my body in that place? And like,
I mean, if you have Jane Fonda.
Yeah. She's an incredible Indigenous rights activist. But so I think about that. I also think about just becoming self-sufficient and having like a little commune of us people that like, you know, Two-Spirit Youth and just other really rad folk to like learn how to like survive whatever's about to come, like, and be self-sufficient and empowered and like start our own little new system. So those are two things I've thought about. But I definitely want to like travel and get a dog and a kayak or something. Something to like help me just after doing this work, like
sounds,
keep breathing.
Yeah, it sounds very Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Well, great. If you could have a celebrity business partner, who would it be?
That is a tough question. I'm not super like into celebrities or pop culture.
What about a poet or literary person or academic?
If I could just have any person as a business partner, well, the first thing that came to my mind, and I don't know why, is I just think Jack Black is so funny. And I think, like, I would just love to get high with him and, like, just shoot the shit. As far as, like, work partners go, I think for me, like, I've always wanted to work with some of the folks that were involved in the American Indian Movement. There's just so many other water protectors out there, like, already right now that I'm really inspired by. And, like, again, I'm not really into the celebrities, but, like, my best friend, Candy Brings Plenty, like, I wish we had funding to just do what we do and, like, not have to worry about, like, where the next gas is going to come for the truck, and we could just go around this country inspiring people and traveling the world. Yeah. Like,
so, or how about they don't build gas lines on beautiful, natural
Yeah, absolutely. Properties. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Yeah. Well, hopefully my next question's not horrible, but who would be in your squad of people? So people that would be around you to support you if you could have anybody.
Well, I've definitely signed both you up. I call them apocalypse team, like just people that like you know are gonna be helpful. So like Bear Grylls, you know, just some like badass, like some of those like southern like fishing people that like everyone thinks they're really crazy. Like, I think those preppers and those some of those like, people, like, really fucking get it.
Like
and,
an like, Alaskan gold miner or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, yeah. So I'd have some of those peeps. I'd have some indigenous badass chiefs and warriors and, like, especially the women in the Amazon right now. Like, I fucking want them in my squad if they'll take me because they're kicking ass and taking names. I think there's some really badass youth right now, like some indigenous youth that are fighting to protect water. So I actually got like a pretty dope squad right now. Yeah. Again, I don't know if that answers your questions, but I definitely like I'm into survival stuff right now just because I think that that is a way to reclaim our indigenous work. Like right now, like 500 people speak Ojibwe, and like if I had all the skills and squad in the world, I'd have like, you know, all my elders with me. And that's really hard to have as an urban Native American person, is just to have your elders in your squad or the youth in your squad. Like, that's something people take for granted that we don't always get every day. So, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
There's no right answer. The answer is the answer that comes from your heart, right?
Yeah.
I don't like asking this question. When you reach a certain level of success, what's your splurge or guilty pleasure purchase?
Well, we just talked about the fact that I have a car. Because I came back to Standing Rock with 25 cents in my pocket. And it just took me a minute to, because I like left my job. And it took me a minute to get back on my feet. And I'm super grateful for the people who like helped me couch surf. And then I had my old car, Golden Pony, for $800. And it had duct tape on it. And I was thinking of the Golden Girls when I bought it. So it was like Golden Pony. And like, as grateful as I am for that car, like I didn't get to leave town. And so like just me getting this car, is like a huge moment in my life.
Does this new car have a name?
Fire Pony.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
That was like Blanche DuBois.
No, this is Fire Pony. It looks like a fire. I'm triple Aries. So, I have what I need. Like, I have everything I need. I feel more than blessed that I have shoes and plenty of access to food, and I get to go on trips, and now I get to go visit the coast. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, what local or national businesses would you like to give a shout out to?
I want to give a shout out to you.
Oh, stop.
Yeah.
Oh, no, tell me more. Oh, no, stop.
I think that I keep bringing your name up. Yeah. This is totally a plant. I'm a plant right now. No, but I keep talking about your business because I was very struck by you immediately. It was like buddies at first sight. But also just I think you are one of those authentic people. And I think that we need more businesses that are modeling this authentic work. And the fact that you're interested, that you're hosting spaces to have these conversations, that you're prioritizing this in your podcast, that you're helping small businesses fulfill their dreams, and that you have an eye out for people who might be really scared to start a business or scared to go to a lawyer or can't really afford it, or like, you know, you just take all the like elitism out of it. And so I just really appreciate that. So that you're a really accessible person. And I support queer owned business, and I think you're a badass. I'll leave it at that.
Enough about me.
The other person I would support right now is Greenhouse or Open House. My buddy Cole Reed.
Cole Reed. I know Cole and Dana, yeah.
Cole and Dana are kicking ass. They have Black Fridays, a space for Black coworkers to come and just be like there and in community. They're hosting amazing community conversations. They're doing activism and business. And Cole just opened up the Greenhouse, which is like across the street and has some really cool stuff over there. So they're pillars of our community, and they've become pillars ever since moving here. And the more support they can get, the better. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cole's actually working on a nonprofit too about institutionalized and systematic racism.
Yeah, called Exit the Maze.
Yeah, and like how to work through it. I think that's really a beautiful thing as well.
Yeah, yeah. Is that your big five questions?
Those are my five questions.
Oh, cool. I had a lot more to talk about than I thought. So thank you for being so inquisitive. One of my love languages is when people ask me questions. I usually I don't ever really talk about myself, even though I know I feel really comfortable in this space. And I feel comfortable talking about racism a lot. But personally, I've had rare moments where people ask me about like my journey or my process. And I usually hide behind asking a bunch of people questions. And so I just feel really loved this evening. And I just want to say thank you for being caring about my story, because sometimes I forget that I am a survivor of like so much trauma and so much trauma ancestrally. And like I'm an Aries, so I love it, but I also hate making it about myself. And I realize that sometimes my story is important because of other people that are struggling through the same stuff. So thank you for reminding me of that.
You're very welcome. And yeah. I told you, I'm choosing very intentionally who we have on this podcast, and I'm glad that I chose you to be a guest and you said yes.
Totally. Anything I can do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
For not just being on the podcast, but for your work in the community and
for
being an authentic, beautiful person.
Samesies.
Hashtag same.
Yeah, that's our hashtag tonight.
Okay. Good to talk to you.
A very big thank you to Court Morse of Prosper Portland. You can check out more information on them at prosperportland.us. Be sure to check out the information we provided earlier in the show on the resources for Bridgeliner, Oregon Health Authority, and the COVID-19 Freelance Artist Resource. Thanks for listening to the podcast today. To find out more about the show or to hear other episodes, go to allofyourbusinesspodcast.com. All of Your Business Podcast is recorded and produced at Track 11 Music in Portland, Oregon.